This is part two of a two-part series of what it means to be an American. Now, clearly, we can't answer that question for everybody, so we've decided to take one particular family as an example. And the family in question belongs to a college classmate of mine. Her name is Bernice Glenn, and she has a particularly interesting history that she wrote about on a website called whatitmeansTobeAnAmerican.org. And I'm so glad that I saw that article because it turns out that Bernice's family is literally a history that spans the Pacific Ocean. It's centered on her home state of Hawaii, but there are lots and lots of permutations. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about what it means to be an American to Bernice.
Stay tuned for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
This is part of a two-part series on what it means to be an American, focused specifically on my college classmate, Bernice Glenn, who has a particularly interesting family history. She's half Japanese, half American, and her family sort of met halfway across the Pacific Ocean in the island of Hawaii. In part one, Bernice was telling me, we went back centuries to her family's history in Japan, and we were just then discussing how her grandfather, who was the head of a Buddhist temple, was trying to bring Buddhist culture and Buddhist values into Hawaii, and how he started some rather interesting organizations. Last week, we finished when he was starting something called the YMBA, the Young Men's Buddhist Association. And right now, Bernice is going to tell us about another youth organization started by her grandfather.
But he also starts the first Buddhist Boy Scouts unit. And,
Buddhist Boy Scouts.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. And, you know, the focus is on being American and leadership. And so he's starting to also expand institutes of Buddhist studies, the concept that you could have institutes that are not temples, that don't require people to feel like they have to be committed as members of a congregation, but just people who are interested in Buddhism. So he has an idea of setting up in Hawaii an annual conference that will bring together Buddhists from all over the world to really, again, emphasize Hawaii as a meeting place of cultures and religions and ethnicities, and also Buddhism as a global religion. So he starts, and he begins with the first several of those and brings in the Dalai Lama. He brings in Buddhists from literally all over the world, and they start in on that. And he starts a global Buddhist library. And then he has a massive stroke and is gone just in minutes.
Oh dear, how old was he?
He was in his 50s. And
what year was this?
So this is in the 1930s, around, I'd say, 1932. Oh, dear. And so my grandmother is there with these two young girls, two daughters, and everyone else is off on their own. And her uncle is sent to come to the temple to start the transition. Because my grandfather had been such a well-known person and had been so anchored in the community, the feeling of the temple was that the transition has to happen quickly. It can't linger. There has to be a clear succession, which had already been put in place. It wasn't a question, but that there has to be a very visible switch, and that the Imamura period, that was their last name, transition out quickly and a new era start. Because there's a feeling that there might be people who have, you know, such loyalty to the Imamuras that they, if there's a delay, there's a vacuum, people will feel uneasy, not knowing who will be the next one. So my grandmother's uncle is sent from Japan to handle the transition. He's an abbot, so he's very high ranking. And he also feels like he can't show favoritism to his niece by, you know, letting her linger. So he has her move out within days of the death. And and so it's a bumpy transition. So she gets passage on a ship back to Japan to get things set up for her daughters to join her. She has to arrange. She's now the head of her husband's family temple in Fukui. So she has to make arrangements to take over there, and she has to find a place for her daughters to live and for her to live as well. And during that time,
and these are two daughters who were born in the U.S. and yes. I'm presuming spoke English for the most
yes.
part.
Yes.
Did they speak any Japanese?
They did. They spoke both. And the funniest thing was, my grandfather had really wanted them to understand and be part of local culture. So and American culture. So he sent them to a school called the Hawaii Mission Academy. He didn't send them to his own Buddhist schools. So the Hawaii Mission Academy is a Christian academy. And they were learning all these songs and, you know, all these different things. And when he was having one of those large conferences with all of these visiting Buddhist leaders, bishops and abbots from Japan, he had them, the two girls, serve tea and cookies to this august group. And one of them asked my aunt, who is the youngest, what do you want to be when you grow up? And she had just come from Hawaii Mission Academy, and she said, I want to be Jesus because everybody loves him.
I was going to comment that those poor girls must have been at least a little bit confused. Oh my gosh, how many different cultures and religions can you mix into those little heads? And so she right. wants to be Jesus because everybody likes him.
Yeah, loves him. Right.
Loves him. Okay.
It's part of the song, you know, that they learn.
Okay then. Oh, well, that's quite a high ambition.
Yes. Well, of course, you know, all of the bishops and abbots turned to my grandfather like, okay, we see there are some kinks in this that have to be worked out. So my grandmother returns. She anchors her role at the temple in Fukui. By now, my uncle has, left Fukui, and he's actually in Hawaii as a priest in one of the largest plantation temples, and so it's just her and the girls, and so they go there, and she calls for her oldest daughter to come to Japan to be with them to help, because she knows this is going to be a tough situation to
the one who had been at Smith.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So you have basically all of the three daughters and the mother and one of the sons who is now a reporter in Japan, all living in Japan. And you have, and the second son has since then returned to Japan. So almost everyone's in Japan at this point. This is, the late 30s and the
Well, I think I know where this is going.
Yes.
It's just to interject here, because again, the chronology is unfamiliar to a lot of people. Japan had already been at war with China since, I think, 1931, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And so there had been war in Asia for the better part of that decade, and relations between the United States and other Western powers and Japan had been deteriorating all throughout that period. So the storm clouds are on the horizon already when they make this this journey over to Japan.
Right. So and she has sort of no other option, because she's been kicked out of the temple very unceremoniously, you know, told to, you should probably go back to Japan. And, you know, there's no way for her to, she doesn't feel to support her young daughters unless she goes back to Japan. So what she has in Japan is, again, Kyoto Women's University, her great-great aunt. And now the university includes a middle school and high school, so the girls can actually go into that school and be there. And she knows that they'll keep up with their English. It's a very, you know, pro-Western school, and it's specifically for women. They'll be taught, you know, leadership traits, hopefully, as women. And it looks like the solution. And my oldest uncle, again, is in Hawaii, and he's just about to be sent to go on for his graduate degree at UC Berkeley, and at the same time to help either work at or take over the temple there in Berkeley. And so so this is, you know, leading up to 1941, basically. Mm. And so they're somewhat anchored. My grandmother is in Fukui taking care of that temple. My her daughters are all
Where is Fukui in Japan?
So it's on the western seacoast.
Western seacoast. So this, south or north?
This is about the middle.
It's about the middle, okay.
So it faces Korea. So it's right on the Sea of Japan. And and then the rest of the family is in Kyoto, at least the girls are. And then one son is in Tokyo. He's the reporter. And one son is in Kobe. So he's the son that was... that was born in Japan really, really wants to work for the American government, and he can't. He sees
because he's not an American citizen.
Right. He sees the storm clouds rising, and he thinks maybe they might need me, you know, bilingual, et cetera. Can't. So he and the family now is economically really at risk. So one of the things in Japanese culture that happens often is when there's a wealthy family who doesn't have a son to carry on their name, they will often approach, in this case, they approached my family to say, your son, born in Japan, bilingual, bicultural, you know, now he's really understands industry. We have a family company that makes kimono fabric. We need a son. Will you essentially give him to us? And there's almost like a dowry. And so in economic straits, a lot of families will acquiesce. I mean, based on not only the financial support, but also that their child then enters into a well-to-do family and that he will be taken care of. And that's what happened with him. So he was my grandmother, to her dying day, really, really regretted that decision because it felt like she was, you know, selling her son in a way. So
well, it didn't lead to an estrangement, did it? I mean, she could still see him. And
yes, but I mean, he was clearly theirs. And that meant, you know, really acquiescing to whatever the father-in-law wanted, and you know, so it sets up a dynamic that's a little tough. So he ends up helping to run that family business, and then you know, we kind of move to the war breaking out, and that's where they are when the war starts.
And that's a very poignant tale. In fact, this is something you directly mention in your essay, is your mother and her sister were in school when they heard about Pearl Harbor, weren't they?
Yes. So my mother was actually, she had just transitioned from high school to university. And my aunt was still in high school. And my mother remembered having the announcement. They're all in school, they're sitting at their desks. So she's now at Kyoto Women's University. All of these women around her who are very close friends with her, and the announcement is made that Pearl Harbor was bombed.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with a college classmate of mine, Bernice Glenn, and we're listening to her fascinating family tale, which spans the Pacific Ocean. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Bernice Glenn. Stick around. Smith, how the heck are you today?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you doing?
I'm doing extremely
well. You look fantastic.
I generally do. You look okay.
You look like a man who's got a great new job.
I do, in fact, have a great new job.
What is it?
I have moved to Knoxville, Tennessee, where I am now teaching at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University, which is a university dedicated to the memory of Abraham Lincoln, which is a pretty cool thing.
Do they have donuts?
They have lots of donuts.
Duncan donuts.
Yes, indeed they do. That's
nice.
Perhaps the worst pun you've made yet on the show. Do we have a contestant?
I'm Ben Vernia from Arlington, Virginia.
Ben Vernia from Arlington, Virginia. And are you a listener?
I am a long-time listener, yes.
A long-time listener. That's sort of a silly question, isn't it? Because why else would you be calling? But okay, glad to hear that you're a long-time listener, Ben. Doug, do you have a question for Ben?
I do. Ben, I'm going to give you a question and give you four choices. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. What is sometimes called the poker game case? What is sometimes called the poker game case? Is it A, Johnson v. Texas, dealing with the rules of Texas Hold'em? B, Roe v. Wade, dealing with women's rights? C, Baxter v. United States, dealing with poker winnings? Or D, Baker versus Missouri, dealing with patented poker chip designs?
Ooh.
Oh, this is a tough one.
It is a tough one, but it's a pretty famous case out of the 80s called the poker game case is sometimes what it's called.
The poker game case.
It came out of 86.
Well, let me see if I can narrow this down a little bit. I don't think it would be Roe v. Wade because I just don't see what that has to do with poker. Johnson v. Texas, I believe, dealt with gay rights or the right for gay people to engage in consensual sex. And I think that was actually not in the 1980s. So I'm going to rule out Johnson v. Texas. What were the other two?
The other two were Baxter v. United States, dealing with poker winnings, or that was C, or D, Baker versus Missouri, dealing with patented poker chip designs. So this is a case that would have gone before the Supreme Court.
I'm going to guess, if it was versus the United States, it might be like a tax case. It might be dealing with poker winnings. I'm not exactly sure why Missouri would be a party to a patent case. So I'm going to guess C.
Ben, you are fantastic. It is, in fact, C. And it's exactly right. It dealt with professional poker players and whether their winnings were, in fact, income and subject to a certain tax rate.
The reason I'm laughing, Ben, and by the way, congratulations, is that was a textbook example of how lawyers think and how law students should at least go through multiple choice exams. You eliminated the first two outliers for very good reasons. And then you narrowed it down to the two tough ones. And then you very carefully noted that the parties in one case didn't seem appropriate. The other one, that was just textbook. And I was watching Doug here as you one by one knocked off all of his red herrings there. So very, very well done. Very well done indeed. And so we're going to send you a T-shirt along with your pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. All you have to do is send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. Give us your T-shirt size, and we will take it from there.
Great. Thank you very much.
But before you go.
Montpelier, by the way.
Pardon me?
I love what they're doing at Montpelier. It's a great place to visit.
Oh, it is a great place to visit. Have you been there?
Oh, a few times, yeah.
Oh, a few times. You know, the slave cabins are being rebuilt now?
They are. We're going to be doing a lot of work between now and next June. And June, put it down, Stuart.
Okay.
Ben, put this on your calendar. June 2017, we're opening a new significant exhibit on the enslaved community at Montpelier in slavery as an institution. It's going to be amazing.
It is going to be amazing. But before we go, just to be accurate, even though you appropriately eliminated choice A, you were thinking of Lawrence versus Texas. That was the gay rights case. Texas versus Johnson, correct me if I'm wrong here, Doug, that's the flag burning case.
It is the flag burning case.
Right. But it didn't matter in the event, so we just wanted to make that clear because we know a lot of lawyers listen to the show and they were probably saying, no, that was the flag-burning case. At any rate, you win, Ben, so thanks for playing and thank you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm speaking with a college classmate of mine, Bernice Glenn. She's telling me the story, the fascinating story of her Japanese-American family, consistent with our theme this week, what it means to be an American. Before the break, we'd gotten to quite a dramatic moment because it seems that several members of Bernice's family were over in Japan on December the 7th, 1941. Her mother was a schoolgirl when she first heard that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor.
And she starts to cry and cry and cry silently, she said, because her home was bombed. This was her home. And she starts to feel eyes on her, and she lifts up her eyes and she sees everyone is turned towards her, and all of a sudden they realize she's American. And that was this horrible feeling of being in a country now at war with her home, and she's now clearly identified as an American, and everyone is now realizing it for the first time.
A terrible moment, and if I may say so, it's even more than that. This is the country of her birth is on one side of the war, and the country of her family heritage is on the other. Her identity itself seems to be at war with
and
itself.
What's really interesting is that when I've spoken to my aunts and my uncles when they were alive and read, you know, some of the letters from my grandmother, there was never a question of divided loyalties between the two countries. They immediately felt great sorrow and pain, but they felt so as how they identified themselves as Hawaii-born Japanese-Americans. You know, and it was very clear in their minds, the second-born son, you know, probably had the hardest situation because he was raised in Hawaii, and he really was raised as an American, and so he couldn't say he was Japanese American, but I think, you know, he really truly embodied that, and so none of them had any question as to loyalty. The one who I think was skirted it and really played with fire, if you will, was the youngest son. So he was the reporter. So he's a Japanese American, he's a Keio graduate. He lands his dream job as a reporter for the Yomiuri newspaper, which is kind of, I guess, the equivalent of maybe the Washington Post. And he's a political reporter, which is what he wanted to be. And everyone seems to have forgotten by now, because he's part of this Keio University old boy network, they seem to have forgotten that he's American. And so his first assignment is to go in as an embedded reporter with the Imperial Japanese Army to Burma and the Philippines and Malaysia. So he's writing his articles from the front lines. And
wait, just a second here. This is a natural-born American citizen who simply happens to be of Japanese ancestry and educated university education in Japan. And now he is a war correspondent riding around with the Japanese Army.
Yes.
And nobody in the Japanese Army or in Japan generally seems to remember the strange circumstances of his birth and citizenship.
Right, because he's...
What an odd position to be in.
Yes, because he's been ushered into that role, which was his dream role of political reporter, through his university network of friends. And it's called... It really is called an old boy network in Japan. I mean, literally, they call it OB. And it there really is a tremendous amount of power in placing people and keeping people in positions, especially in that era, to the point where, you know, his Americanness was never even questioned or revealed. You know, it's just nerve-wracking to the rest of the family because they know. And
I imagine if that had come out at a bad moment, that he might have been considered a spy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Jeez Louise. Okay.
So while the women of the family are all in Japan and they're trying to just live, basically, the men of the family are faced with, you know, these other kind of unique challenges. And the stories that I would hear mostly from my aunts and my mother about how they were treated in Japan was just initially they were given rations, these ration tickets, and you had to take trains that interconnected with other trains to get to the ration distribution center and bring it back out to Kyoto, where they lived. My grandmother was in Fukui, where there's a lot of rice that's grown there. They're known for their pure water and really great, very sort of well known for the quality of the rice that's grown there. And so they're not as affected as the cities because they're growing their own food. But the girls are in Kyoto and it's very limited food, if any, and they're sent in on these missions to get their rations. And they're the young ones, so they go and get it. And at every train stop, because they have on their identification that they are Americans, the Japanese soldiers who were there early, this is early in the war, would harass them and take half of their rations and make a scene, you know, at every stop point. It's, the point is for other people to hear it and see it. And they come back, you know, literally with a handful of rice after that whole trip for their aunts and themselves and the people who work at the temple and at the university. So they're left with very little. And they would talk about how interesting it was. This is all in positive terms, how interesting it was and challenging it was to find what types of roots of grass or even weeds and grasshoppers and other insects, how to find the ones that tasted the best when they were cooked in soy sauce and oil and a little bit of sugar. You know, it became an adventure for them, the way that they recast it, I think, in their minds. Frankly, it may have been a coping, post-event coping mechanism, but
it might have been. But on the other hand, you know, kids do look at things differently.
They do.
And, it's just a big adventure, yes. You know, perhaps to some extent. In fact, that brings us to how you opened your essay. You talked about how you used to sit around as a child and listen to your aunts talking to each other and reminiscing a number of years later.
Yes.
And that's how you learned a lot of this family lore, wasn't it?
Yes, it really was. Every night after dinner, they would sit at this formica dining table in Honolulu, and they were in their 40s, and they would reminisce, and they would tell stories, and every story would add a different layer of color or information or dates or places to sort of this fabric that was starting to come together in my mind about where everyone was and how they had been all scattered and how deeply profound each one's sort of journey was. And but they'd sit around and discuss it and laugh and, you know, sort of enjoy some of the ironies that were, you know, in some cases, they're pretty dark ironies.
Indeed. Well, that took us up to the 1960s and 70s when you were a little girl. So let's back up. I don't want to skip those 30 or so years. Let's go back. They're stuck in Japan. They're getting their rations taken away. They're being harassed. Everyone's sort of on pins and needles, I'm guessing.
Yes.
For the duration of the war. What else happened to them? How did they get through the war?
So the girls worked at the university, Kyoto Women's University Library, in the Western language section, which allowed them to be constantly translating and using their English language skills. And that was intentional. My grandmother wanted to make sure that they had nothing to do with the war effort, that they wouldn't go to work in any of the factories or anything that was doing anything to support the Japanese military. And so,
yeah, because that would have made it very tough for them when they went back to the United States.
Well, and she thought it would also make, it would also put a divide in their integrity, their personal integrity, too.
Sure, there's that. Yeah, sure.
So so they were, you know, very lucky because their great-grandaunt runs the university, so they can...
That's a help.
Yeah, so they were, you know, very privileged to have that opportunity. So they do that throughout the war. They're living with some aunts the food situation gets worse. The soldiers, my mother said, the ones that had harassed them early on, all of a sudden are gone. There are no men. They all of a sudden there are no young men or even boys. And no old men left. They've all been pulled into the military. And so the only ones who are left who are harassing them are the intelligence officers. And they come usually at night, right around dinner time or right afterwards to question them. And their questions are all about, you know, have they been writing to or hearing from anyone in Hawaii, anyone in the U.S., you know, show us your letters, your correspondence, your papers. We know you've received, you know, some letter on this date, show it to us, type of thing. And if they didn't, they would, you know, basically tear up the house looking for it. So they despise these people, but they prepare for it. And so that was kind of the main thing. But the food situation is getting a lot worse. And two aunts, and I don't know enough about this side of the story, but two of the aunts who lived with them eventually died of malnutrition. And they were giving up, you know, whatever they had to the girls. So when the war is coming to a close, they're being told that the Americans are going to invade at some point, and they will not question whether you're American or not. These are the intelligence officers trying to pressure them to give up any information they might have. And they said, you know, they're going to look at you. They're not going to say, are you Japanese Americans? They're going to assume you're Japanese, and American soldiers will rape and kill, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to, you know, tell us everything you know. And in the meantime, they were all trained in self-defense, which was part of their training anyway, but it was increased as the war was coming to an end for women. And so they go through that training, and they are terrified that when Americans do come, they'll be, you know, they'll be seen as Japan Japanese, and they're not sure what will happen. They don't know about the bomb. They have family in Hiroshima. They have.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
My grandmother's family temple is in Hiroshima, and and Kyoto was going to be one of the bomb sites until General MacArthur put a stop to that because it was such a national treasure site historically.
Yeah, Kyoto is the ancient imperial capital.
Yes.
And has a lot. It's very significant in Japanese history, and you obviously know more about it than I do. But yeah, I had heard that had been on the target list and had been taken off.
Yes, and so they don't know that at the time. They do hear planes going over more frequently, American planes. They can see them. So they do know that you know, it's getting probably close to the end of the war. And then all of a sudden, there's a radio announcement with the Emperor of Japan declaring that the war is over and that everyone must surrender. And the one impression that was consistent across my aunt's recollections was that no one had ever heard the Emperor speak before. He's a deity in Japanese culture, literally a descendant of the sun goddess, Amaterasu. And so no one had heard him speak. And when he spoke, he had such a high, thin, tinny voice that none of them could believe it. They were more absorbed about his voice than they were about his message. They could not believe this was the voice of the Emperor of Japan. And then, of course, the message
didn't sound like God.
No, at all. And, you know, it was just shocking. And then, of course, the message was Japan has surrendered. And so they braced themselves for the occupation, not knowing, again, you know, having heard what might happen, not knowing what would happen. And in the meantime, throughout all of this, you know, my grandmother is sort of half in Fukui and half in Kyoto. They're going back and forth all the time. It's not a short distance, and so there is a freeze in transportation for a while. Their trains are not running; they're waiting, and then the occupation starts.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Bernice Glenn, who's telling me the fascinating tale of her Japanese American family, specifically the part of her family that was trapped in Japan during World War II. After the break, we'll finish our conversation with Bernice. Stick around. You're not going to want to miss it. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish my conversation with Bernice Glenn, all about her Japanese-American family, a family that met in Hawaii but kept going back and forth across the Pacific to the point where some of her family members, including her mother, were trapped in Japan as American citizens, most of them anyway, during the Second World War. Before the break, we had just gotten through the war. Now let's find out what happened to Bernice's family after the war concluded.
Before we go there, you've been emphasizing how much they've been told they're going to suffer at the hands of the Americans. They're going to be brutalized and raped and perhaps killed. That's extremely important because, of course, that was the Japanese propaganda, and it had been the Japanese propaganda throughout the war. And, of course, there were the terrible suicides that occurred, I believe, in Saipan and in other places. And that ultimately was one of the justifications that was given for using the atom bomb was that the Japanese populace was so trained to defend itself and was so convinced that they were going to fight to the death that it was going to lead to a bloodbath on both sides. And so it's interesting to hear about it from the other side. So I guess there was a lot of propagandizing going on and there was a lot of training going on. And they must have been terrified.
Yes, they were. And my mother, you know, years later, she became a Japanese language professor at a liberal arts college. And she would be asked by many people to speak on behalf of, you know, peace movements because she had gone through this experience and had seen it from both sides, and she came from a Buddhist family and et cetera. And I would attend these events with her, and they would hand over the microphone to her, and they would say, "What do you, you know? Would you say is the most important thing to ensure peace, so that something like the bomb, atom bomb, doesn't happen again?" And she would say, "America has to maintain the strongest military and defense possible so that this can never happen again, because no matter what we think, there will always be groups and communities and nations who will spread that propaganda and ensure that their civilians think that, that their communities think that America will come in and kill." And so you have to have both. You have to have an extremely strong military and an extremely strong nation-building side. Of course, at these peace conferences, a big hook would come out to drag her off the stage.
I'm saying that's not going to fit the narrative very well. In fact, was she asked point blank how she felt about the atomic bombings? Did she have an opinion on those?
Yes, she was very, very, very clear that without the atomic bomb being dropped, so many more, millions more, would have died, and that the atomic bomb was the only way, from her perspective, that Japan would surrender.
Well, that is certainly consistent with the historical record I'm familiar with, but it's not a popular opinion these days.
No, it's not.
Not at all. I mean, there's a lot of moral outrage over the atomic bomb and a lot of rejection of those more practical arguments that were made at the time. But the simple fact was that the propaganda was there, the training was there. And if you convince people that they and their children are all going to be raped and killed, then they will fight to the death, and they might end up, you know, committing suicide, as happened in some places.
And you do have to remember where the Japanese military was sent. They did rape and kill.
That's true as well.
So you know, that's sort of the ironic side is, of course, the American military, and I have to say this, I know how they were trained and how they were prepared for the invasion, and it was definitely to restrict interaction between soldiers and the community other than getting them disaster relief, because my dad was in the first group that was initially supposed to invade Japan as a paratrooper, and he ended up being one of the first to secure the airfield for General MacArthur to land.
Good grief. Did you were on, your family was completely on both sides of this.
Yes.
let's finish with your mom's side first, and then let's come back and talk about Dad, the paratrooper. Okay, go on, please. Finish. How did your mom and the rest of your family get out of Japan at the end of the war, or did they?
They did. They did. Mm-hmm. So what happened was immediately after the American military came through, they started to identify who spoke English. And then, you know, they went through a very careful sifting process and realized that these were Japanese Americans. And there were groups of them stuck in Japan. So they started to engage them in working for the U.S. government. And one of the first things that happened was my aunt was started to work for the American consulate. My uncle, who had been the kimono factory guy, the one who had been adopted by the other family, had the opportunity to work for the U.S. consulate as well as an interpreter, and jumped at the opportunity. My other aunt and my mom then started as interpreters, and then ended up working on some really exciting programs, including one that took emerging Japanese leaders, to include the future Prime Minister Nakasone, on a tour of America to learn about democracy and the political process, and to start rebuilding their internal structures and political infrastructure. So mom and her youngest sister were able to get out of Japan. They had secured enough money for transport, and they didn't know where they were going to go, but their oldest brother was in Berkeley, and he was helping to resettle all of these people who had been in the concentration camps, in the internment camps, and was very actively running hostels, you know, to help people relocate. And my mom and her aunt show up on his doorstep. Of course, he knew they were coming, but literally show up on his doorstep. And he's living a very meager life. I mean, he was a priest, and he was running these hostels and these boarding homes. And at the same time, he was working at the University of California, Berkeley, in the anthropology department. And he was cleaning toilets at night to make ends meet. And so they arrive thinking they've just left this war-torn country, and this is America. Everything will be as they remembered it in Hawaii. And instead, you know, it's this tiny, cramped house. And my uncle and his wife, and his wife was amazing. She's just this power of nature. But anyway, they have these little kids. They have four little kids. And my aunt and my mom arrive in the middle of the night. They're given one small bed to sleep on, and they're constantly bumping into each other on the bed, but they're just happy they're on a bed. They wake up in the morning, and these four little heads, the four little kids, are peering at them, looking at them, trying to figure out who it was who bumped them out of their bed.
I can just see that. I've been in bed when my kids would come up, and they're just you open your eyes, and they're about 3 inches away from you, just staring at them.
Right.
And those kids must have.
It was like the size of a twin size bed, and the four kids used to sleep head to toe on it. And all of a sudden they're bumped from it, and they're on the floor because their two big aunts decide to just flop in from Japan.
Right.
So my aunt and my mom started to work at the International House at Berkeley, and they went on from there to they found jobs eventually in Washington D.C. working for the Library of Congress, and sort of started their careers from that point.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, but we're going to have to make this quick. But now it's time to hear about Dad. Dad was a paratrooper who was going to head into Japan?
Yes. So Dad was a West Point graduate of 1939, which was the class that fed into World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And he was part of what was called the 541st Parachute Infantry Regiment. They were a test bed, trying to test out the latest ways of doing things like jumping from 200 feet instead of 800 feet. It didn't work. And doing like jumping on the enemy instead of away. So he was tapped for the Pacific and Asia. And so he spent his time through the Philippines in a particularly brutal hand-to-hand combat period in Okinawa, and was...
That was one of the highest casualty rates of any invasion.
It
something
was,
like 80%, wasn't it?
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Two of his planes with his troops crashed on landing, so he lost them right away. And then he, after several battles, he was standing there sort of with two of his best NCOs on either side, and snipers took both of them out through the throat, which is like one of the worst ways to die. And it was the one point in the whole war where he said he thought he could maintain his humanity. You know, the Japanese military had been dropping these photographs to demoralize American troops, showing Japanese soldiers beheading beheading American soldiers. And instead, of course, that ignited them. And he thought, I will never let myself get so depraved that I would fall to that level of brutality. But when his two NCOs were shot in the throat right next to him, he said he just saw red. And he went cave to cave, sniper hunting, he called it. And it was hand to hand. And he had told his NCO to have the troops ready. They were getting ready to board within hours for the invasion of Japan. And he said, if I don't come out of the caves, you know, it's the major will take you forward. And so he said he just saw red, and he went through that. He came out, and this is now maybe a few hours before boarding. And his men wrote letters that are now in this museum at Fort Bragg that said he didn't even realize it. When he came out of the caves, he was covered in blood, and he didn't know that. And he was ordering them, you know, to get all the equipment ready, and they were supposed to, this was the big last-minute prep before the invasion. And he tried to look at his watch, and it was encrusted with blood, and he was sort of dazed. He kept trying to rub it off, and they realized he was probably still in shock. And right at that moment, they get the news that Japan had surrendered, and their mission now has changed. And it's not to invade, but rather to provide humanitarian assistance. But they were told the Japanese may be ready to fight to the death, so you're authorized to shoot anything that moves. So he takes his troops, and they secure Atsugi Airfield, which is where General MacArthur will land. And he's walking forward towards this naval commander who's walking towards him. And the naval commander has a sword in his hand, and it's a very old family sword, and it's really kind of historic and beautiful. And he hands over the sword with the surrender of the airfield to my dad. And his troops are on one side, and dad's troops are on the other, and they're watching each other, not sure what's going to happen. But dad said later, you know, they didn't know what to expect. And what they found was an extremely orderly, extremely respectful group of what was left of the military and populace that was just ravaged by disease and malnutrition. So
and where was this again?
Atsugi Airfield is the name of the airfield
where is that?
It's in on the main island of Honshu.
And, okay, so it's near Tokyo.
Yes, yes.
Okay, and so that's where, when you said that's where General MacArthur was going to land to accept the surrender.
To accept, well, Dad had to accept the surrender of the airfield, but General MacArthur was to land to then start the occupation of Japan formally.
Right, accept the surrender of the whole country.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Okay, but your dad was there first.
Yeah, well,
he
had to clear the airfield to make sure it was really, you know, because they didn't know.
I guess it makes sense that it would be paratroopers who would do that.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, I'm sure that we're just skipping over all sorts of fascinating things, but I guess that the last question I have is then, how did it happen that a man who had clearly had some pretty strong feelings about at least Japanese soldiers ended up getting together with a Japanese-American woman?
Well, a couple of things. He became the military governor of the eastern part of Hokkaido. That's the very large island in the northernmost part of Japan. And in that capacity, his mission was to protect and to help rebuild Japan. And he fell in love with it. And part of his role was also to establish a language school, language, culture, history school for occupying American officers in the occupation forces, rather, and so that they would appreciate and understand and be respectful of the country that they were helping to rebuild. And he interviewed, he went back to D.C. to interview people to help coordinate the establishment of the school. And my mom came in as an interviewee, and he said she walked in, and I just thought, I'm going to marry her.
And he did.
And he did. Although it wasn't, it wasn't like, you know, the simplest landing he's ever had, but took a little bit of coaxing.
I bet it did. And again, I'm sorry I can't go into all sorts of detail here, so we'll have to skip forward. You obviously resulted from that union. You later sat at the feet of your aunts and listened to their marvelous stories. And your children have followed in the tradition of family service, haven't they?
Yeah, so I'm really proud. My oldest son is in his last year at West Point, and my youngest son is a freshman at UC Davis, hoping to become a psychiatrist someday, and my oldest one wants to become an Army doctor, although he's been strongly encouraged to, especially now as we're facing definitely conventional war within the next 5 years. He and his classmates have been encouraged to go into combat first. So he's going to go through combat engineering and hopefully become an Army doctor at some point in his career. It's what he's
always sounds been. Ominous. Which conventional war are we expecting within 5 years?
I'm pretty sure Russia's going to be involved.
oh, dear. Well, please don't frighten me. Don't frighten me in that regard. Well, I don't want to hear about a war with Russia.
Well, you know, I think the big thing is if you look at Syria and Libya, we're already mm-hmm. there. Everyone, I think, has looked with a lot of, they've taken a lot of convenient, sort of a convenient view of special operations forces being there in the thousands as if we're not there, but we are. And special operations forces are our people. And
right.
It's the same thing.
And there are Russian pilots flying right over them.
Yes.
And dropping bombs. Yeah, that scares me too as an old national security guy. Yeah. But that's a whole other subject. But that actually does bring us back to you, and it brings us full circle. Your job is actually serving as well. You work in the national security field now too, don't you?
Yes. I'm really lucky to work in a field where I help to prospect for innovation that will help what are going to be not large bases of soldiers spread out all over the place. They're these smaller expeditionary forces that will be, you know, constantly trying to generate their own energy, their own water. They're going to be constantly surrounded and in really cut off from communications through cyber jamming and things like that. And so these are going to be very different kinds of groups of soldiers who have to think independently and have technology at their fingertips that will help them. And so the field that I'm in is in the energy and energy-related technologies to make sure that they have the best that they can in any situation.
Well, Bernice Glenn, my classmate from Princeton, class of 83, I thank you very much for sharing this remarkable tale with us.
I
congratulate you on your family's contributions to our country and to your own contributions now, though I sincerely hope you're wrong.
Yes,
in your assessment
too.
That
I do too.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. In terms of future wars, I certainly hope we can avoid that. Perhaps, as your mother likes to say, if we stay strong, we can avoid that sort of thing.
I'm hopeful.
I'm hopeful as well. But thank you very much. And let me be the last person, I'm sure, of many to suggest you ought to write a book.
Thank you, Stuart. I'm considering it. I really appreciate it, though. And I appreciate this opportunity. I mean, your program is so important. And it made me think more deeply about things and look into other people's stories, too. So thank you very much.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my classmate of the Princeton class of 1983, Bernice Glenn. Wow, Bernice, that was just such a great tale. It was so inspiring. Your family is inspiring, and thank you for sharing it with us. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, no matter where your family came from.